one of the themes of the one of the initial attempts to put a handle on the conference, the symposium, one of the recurring words was post-denominational, and that just rings all kinds of bells out of the China experience. And I thought, well, why not? As it turned out, the word has hardly appeared. And sort of been taken over, and not in a bad way. My more positive concept is the emerging church. At least it's not post-something. It is something. And that's all right. At the same time, post-denominational is one of those words that increasingly appears out there in writings about major trends in the United States. And for a church body as denominationally loyal and identified, self-identified as we are, post-denominationalism presents some major concerns, some questions, challenges. And I thought one way, sometimes it happens that one way to go at what would otherwise be a delicate or a sensitive subject is to try to find a way to come at it from the side rather than go in somehow defensively or confrontationally or something or other. And that allows me to think that there is one church out there that very proudly and very self-consciously calls itself post-denominational. And it may have entered that state in a sense of threat that was something imposed. On the other hand, that's not what it is anymore. It's a very proud form of self-identification. I thought, well, okay, let's just take that and kind of describe it a little bit and see if maybe there's some things that are of interest or things that can be learned in terms of our American setting. But let's start with the American setting. How would you describe, or what do you think are some of the aspects of, hi Jim, post-denominationalism. What kind of things come to mind? What post-denominational in terms of the United States context? What are the agendas? What's the baggage? Where's the bite?
I think of church.
Okay. Now, that can happen in denominational settings, too. In a city like St. Louis, where you got, I don't know, how many LCMS churches? 60, 70, 80? Just LCMS. Forget ELCA or Wisconsin or whatever. Can easily happen. But you're right. It can also happen without regard to denominational identity or theology or anything. What else? Yeah.
I'm not specifically a Methodist.
Okay.
Specifically a
Presbyterian. Okay. Or like the person filled out the application form to whatever university. I'd be willing to be a Methodist. Okay, now that's kind of movement originally in a denominational identity toward the outside.
Yeah.
There is that. I think generally post-denominational is really talking more about a movement out there, though, not just individual Christians and not just some sense of identity within a denomination. Can you think of post-denominational or non-denominational churches out there? You guys have been in the cocoon too long here.
And I can't quite remember the name of it now, but it rode on the personalities of the pastor.
Okay. The one that was mentioned by Putnam a number of times, largely because he spent some time studying it, is a Saddleback out in Irvine, California. Okay. Right. Okay. Okay. What do you think the agenda of a post-denominational church is? Why are they post-denominational? And I guess we're also dealing with a little bit of a distinction between non-denominational and post-denominational. And my working sense is that My working sense is that there's a lot of overlap between these two. They're not coterminous. Any thoughts in terms of what drives that sense of identity, that sense of wanting to be either un or non or post?
I think they don't want affiliation.
Okay. Hang on to that thought, because I want to press the question why. But then you're adding another dimension, which is not just un or non or post, but a little bit anti. Not serious, not malicious, not hostile or anything, but the sense, I'm not going there. I don't want that. Now, sorry, you were going to say. Okay.
Just flat out, and they, most of the time, they'll say they felt like the worship was dead, or they feel like the worship's a lot more lively than not in the church.
Okay, or some of the other things some of the speakers mentioned were, in addition to worship, a sense of lack of social commitment, kind of a hypocritical lifestyle on the part of church members, no love, no nothing positive in the high. In the life of the church, a lot of those kinds of things. I'd like to take it though to the step of the people who are driving the post-denominational church. Why are they wanting to go that road? And I'll throw it back to you if you got a thought there.
Well, I think that they're wanting to go down that road because
Hey, chamo su ni hao.
Thank you.
For those of you who don't know him, this is Dr. Chan, Timothy Chan, who is pastor of the Chinese Gospel Church in West County here in St. Louis, a good friend of Concordia Seminary. Okay. A sense, in other words, that denominations can be stultifying.
Yes.
Not just the local congregation, but the denomination. Self-serving?
Yeah.
Operating in competition or rivalry with other denominations out there? And expecting sometimes the congregations of the denomination to serve the denomination rather than the denomination being in service to the congregation. And maybe other factors as well. But that's the kind of thing that you hear out there a lot. It's in that sense, we say that, again, post-denominational is probably a bit closer to anti-denominational than to non-denominational. And the minute, one other factor I guess to put on the table is, I think, also a strong drive toward the localism of the postmodern era we live in. a little bit suspicious of the overarching and the national and the transcending, and a stronger desire to do our own thing and to do it with our resources, on our terms, with our agenda. In that sense, denominations seem long ways away. To the extent that a Saddleback, and I don't know anything really about Saddleback, starts planting subsidiaries in other places, then basically it becomes a denomination. It may not call itself that, but the minute it's no longer localized, but it's multi-local, then it takes on some of the dynamic of a denomination. Or what's Seibel's up in Crystal? No. Willow Ridge, thank you. Yeah, similar kind of thing. It gets so big that on the impetus of its own growth, it spreads. And as soon as it spreads, the dynamic changes. And it's no longer just a local ministry. It's kind of denominational. But also in the sense that they would like to do their own, have their own organization, train their own leadership, use their own worship forms and even worship materials, administer their own mission operations, service, relief involvements, and so on and so on. Okay, any further thought? Well, that's not our topic. It's kind of intro to the topic, though. Anything else you want to put on the table just about post-denominational as a mindset in an American context? Mm-hmm. Right.
Of the suspicion of meta-narrative.
Yep.
Of the large-scale analysis.
Yep. Yep. Large-scale programs, right. Large-scale vision. Mm-hmm. Yep. And letting somebody else do it. Yeah. Sorry.
The thing that comes to mind is sort of this, why can't we just all get along?
Okay. In that sense, denomination seen as it's kind of divisive, self-protective, in that sense, a hindrance to that kind of cooperative ministry or cooperative sense of body of Christ. All right, let's go to China, because China is post-denominational by recent heritage anyhow, and certainly by deep conviction at this point. But it is a unique situation, quite different from ours in the States here. It doesn't mean there's nothing to learn. It does mean, though, that it really is quite different. I have given you kind of an outline. It's sort of historical until we get to, or chronological, until we get to the last section or two. The word that you find on here that you may not be used to is liberation, used in the sense of the communist takeover of the mainland. I grew up in my early years in Taiwan, Pastor Chan also, whereas those were... that takeover was a wretched thing. That was just not, a good thing, and there were bad words for it. And all of a sudden, you start operating in the context of the People's Republic of China, where shortcut word for 1949 and the communist takeover is liberation. And after close to 20 years in Taiwan, it took a long time before I could say that without swallowing pretty hard. I don't know about Pastor Chan. Did you have that sense too? Yeah.
I think in our congregation, we have more and more people coming from China. So I have to say, it's like that liberation now.
Yeah. Anyhow, anymore, it just becomes a cipher that identifies an event. And even though it's loaded to some, you just swallow and live with it. Therefore, pre-liberation is the time before 1949, when China was still open, when It was open particularly to foreign involvement, business, diplomacy, as well as mission effort. And that is where the context kind of starts here. Pre-liberation, time when foreign mission agencies were there, and I divided that here into three different kinds. Early denominational mission outreach, virtually everything that was done, I say virtually, was done in terms of a planting church. Certainly anything that came out of the United States generally was the normal mission agency is the church, a little different from the European setting where the normal agency is a mission society. And therefore, Lutherans were planting Lutheran churches and Anglicans outside of England, planting Anglican and so on and so on. You had a replication of bodies in China that related to and resembled in terms of their ethos and their liturgy and their theology and so on what the home church was like. It's not the only dynamic that was there, though, and we pick up the others because they're part of what leads into the dynamic after liberation. There were the trance or non-denominational bodies as well. And I found when I looked it up in the dictionary, the word "the" does not get sliced off. It's part of the official name, so listed under T. The Evangelical Alliance Mission, big, growing out of some of the alliance bodies in Scandinavian churches, and with then movement to the States as well, at least in Taiwan, they were big, and they were in China as well. Probably the biggest one of all is the China Inland Mission, begun in the mid-1800s, up to darn close to 1,000 missionaries at their high point. And the presence and the shadow of China Inland Mission is just humongous. It was set up, however, consciously to be not to be a denominational body, but trance or non-denominational, and they welcomed anything from Anglicans all the way to Pentecostals with a few tensions back and forth now and again. But they set themselves up in such a way to kind of find ways to downplay the tensions, even if it meant just simply a comity arrangement where, okay, you Anglicans work over here and the Presbyterians over here and the Baptists down here, which works fine until things grow and there's mobility and pretty soon you start overlapping and bumping into each other. And then there is that inevitable, clash may be too strong a word, but the bumping of traditions. Maybe more important than either of these, however, was the growth of indigenous bodies. That is to say, strong Chinese Christian leaders who, in the nature of things already in this pre-liberation era, just were not interested in being part of a foreign denominational agenda. And some of the names that stand out are, who are the names, Pastor Chun, that you would think of?
Watchman Nee.
Watchman Nee. Do you know the name? Okay, a group called by outsiders, the Little Flock, in terms of their own name, Assembly Hall or something like that, powerful leader. He knew denominations, but he was not part of one. Any others you can think of? John Song. Song Shangjie, right. And others would be Wang Ming Tao. Names that... Okay, boy, good. You got one that wasn't even on my list. Samuel Lam, one still operating in Guangzhou.
Where did they arise from?
Well, they're all from within China.
Well, no, but I mean, were they originally Christian because of denominational outreach, or does this go back before the denominational and trans-denominational mission agencies?
There is... Plymouth Brethren.
Yeah, Plymouth
Brethren. Right.
And John Song, he grew up in a Methodist pastor family, but he came to the U.S. and studied at Ohio State University. born again. Now, while he was a union senator, and he had some clash with the liberal establishment. And, yeah, he was sent into a prison for like maybe 6 months. Then he returned to Taiwan. He was sent into the psychiatry, an institution for 6 months because of his form again, his evangelism favor, so school putting into the institution.
But what I was asking was something like this. Under point B3, you didn't mean something like in India, some old thing going back supposedly.
Nope. The church was there from almost a similar age in history, but in very interrupted forms of history. No trace like that.
Yeah.
Another way to say it is, and I want to sound triumphalistic when you say this, but nobody became Christian without some kind of mission impetus. On the other hand, they didn't grow necessarily in ways that were beholden to or were, nurtured by. Okay? All right, but that was part of an impetus, and we're at halfway through our time already. Part of the impetus already in pre-liberation days toward a post-denominational or a non-denominational form of Christianity. We need to move into liberation. 1949, first period, to 1960, time when originally China was simply wanting to put things together again. It had just been through World War II, much of which was fought on Chinese soil. Devastating time, and much loss of crops, loss of life, loss of almost everything, and just being in charge didn't mean that life was going to work. Besides that, they'd been in civil war for how long? Therefore, China came into its ascendancy with a kind of a double agenda, basically one agenda, and that is to allow China to stand again with pride among the nations of the world. To do that, a couple of things had to happen. One is to get the smothering presence of foreign powers out of China, because they were sucking up, taxes and land and special privileges and just all kinds of stuff. And second thing was get rid of religion, as religion was a parasitic body that was sucking up the energy, the money, the manpower of China. And so with an atheistic agenda, and it's not a put down to say that, it is communism self-identified, came to power, and that was an early bit of agenda. On the other hand, just because it was in power, it couldn't do everything in one swell swoop. It, among other things, called Christians together to kind of lay some rules, try to find ways by which Christians could be made, even if secondary citizens, still sort of productive citizens of China. Unfortunately, came Korean War, like within a year after the communists took control, which put Christians in a very precarious situation because, for one thing, they were religious in an atheistic state. They had ties to that set of nations out there that were in war with China. Where is their loyalty? Who are these people? And when things really got... I'm getting ahead of the game here a little bit. Government really began a steady bit of crackdown, suppression of the Christian church, allowed denominations to live for a while. 1958 was kind of the time when there was an enforced unification, they called it, of religion. Let me just read a document from those days. 1958 was the high tide of the great leap forward. In the church, pastors were given intensive instruction in the socialist reconstruction of the country with emphasis upon mobilizing all available men and resources for material production. The study insisted that pastors were parasites upon society. Church buildings were public resources going to waste. The inevitable result was drafting of pastors for labor, freeing of as many churches as possible to be turned over to the government. Everyone recognized that after we unite, the old denominational names must disappear. Personnel must be unified and not continue along old denominational lines, but each may be appointed according to his ability and nature of the task. Building, property, finances must be administered in common. Organizational structure must be unified. Everything not in accordance with socialism must be reformed. Document out of those days. Kind of like the Prussian Union, only a little bit different. Prussian Union was really, it was not in a state of crisis. It was a state of national kind of reorganization. It was kind of bringing together some pretty strong bodies in ways that maybe they wanted or didn't want. Whereas this was kind of something, a form of suppression on a shrinking Christian church. Shrinking in part because all foreign bodies were out, all foreign money was out, all foreign manpower, human resources were out, the institutions, hospitals, universities, social ministry programs, all begun and financed by outside powers were suddenly orphaned, and government took them over, which they would have anyhow, but that meant that the church really shriveled in society and in their own identity. That was 1558. Sidestep. This combination of factors underlines the fact that post-denominationalism in China is not something fueled by the entrepreneurial drive of a desire for localized life and freedom of choice. This was something imposed on the church in China, nor was post-denominationalism some form of ecumenical union merger movement. The judgment of one who probably knows as much as any other about this era says, the ecumenical movement simply did not deal with the emerging Chinese national consciousness. It lacked Chinese roots. It was an irrelevant factor in China. Dealing with a whole unique body. At the same time, one other implication to this point. Church in China being driven to this kind of post-denominational state in a shrinking context, the point of emphasis or concern was not doctrinal discussions that allow you to be in a post-denominational state. Doctrinal was not the problem, it was not the issue, nor were other ecclesiological or ecclesiastical concerns what drove things. In fact, unity was not even the goal. It was a practical, to use someone else's terms, practical cooperation among Christians working together in the face of an increasingly hostile government. Therefore, let me say one more thing, and then you may have it. Therefore, even to this day, there is no Chinese Christian church in China. Closest you get is the Chinese Christian Council of Churches. Unity is still something down the road. And it has to do with bringing together different denominational heritages and emphases and so on. Sorry. Yep. Yep. Well, and supportive in the war effort and the reconstruction, in one sense, understandable. In fact, I got a course going now, Christianity in East Asian context, which brings into the picture also the Japanese experience and the Korean experience. And I came to realize that during the Second World War, the Japanese Empire, the government, demanded the same kind of union in its circles, initially in Japan, all Protestants became the United Christian, the United Church of Christ in Japan. Fell apart kind of after the war, not completely, and expected the same of the colonies of Japan. That was Taiwan, and it was Korea, and other places. So this impetus by a government with completely different and not democratic goals or agendas, it's not something unique only to China. Governments in a time of crisis consolidate. And the touchy ones or the threatened ones kind of identify, and that leads us to the next point, identify places or points at which potential disagreement or non-cooperation could arise. Post-liberation 1960 to 1980. This period, from Chinese perspective, is termed the Cultural Revolution. Three Cell Patriotic Movement was the, actually the initial, interestingly, the initial form of that body is the Chinese Christian Anti-American Support Korea Three Self Reform Movement. It's kind of a catchy title, right? Which indicates the context in which it arose, right? Namely, the need to, in this war setting to bring all the resources together. It indicated also the cutting off of all ties with the outside world. And later on, the contentious part of that title got taken off, and it became simply the Three Self Patriotic Movement, designed to do two things. One is to be the liaison between Christian bodies and the government. In that sense, a political body. Not a lobby. That indicates some kind of freedom. It's really not that. And the second thing is to align the Christian church in its political loyalties and its support along with the government. Okay, not just the war, but the whole socialist reconstruction of the nation. That was at the time. What's important there is that was the only form of trans church existence, only form of association. In the nature of things, it is already post-denominational, or really non-denominational. That led the church that was done in the early 50s, led the church until the Cultural Revolution, when even that was forbidden. It was outlawed, until finally it came back to life again after the Cultural Revolution. Right.
You know, maybe 100 years earlier than in 19th century. Yeah, because they really want the local church to become that kind
right.
of church.
Right.
Yeah, so Chinese church say that now they don't want Western missionaries to be in China, so they want to
Right. So the missiological strategy or the goal kind of became a death sentence on a church in China, which wasn't there yet, and certainly had not planned ahead to attain these goals. In any case, went into, now this is the next period, and again, I'm looking at the clock as I'm going through this, horrid Cultural Revolution, the most bizarre time in, well, I don't know all of Chinese history, but what I know of it, the most bizarre time out there. Chairman Mao, in one sense, kind of fighting for his political life. A lot of threats to his power, which doesn't make the news a whole lot. And one of his ways of kind of protecting himself was by trying to rekindle the revolutionary fervor out there. And he did that by bypassing all the political structures. He bypassed the military and kind of let the youth loose on the nation, the Red Guard. What was shared with people of China was the rekindling. What was not shared so much, but is coming more and more to light, is how self-serving that rekindling was used. I was manipulated. One of the dynamics of that time was identifying anyone who could be a possible source of non-patriotism. And that would include anyone who'd had any decent kind of education, anyone particularly who had any Western or outside ties, not just Western, but also ties with Japan or, you know, on the outside, any people of any significant religious sensibilities, whatever the religion. These kinds of people were kind of classified with a legal classification of enemy of the state. That's a horrid classification when it becomes a legal classification. Best you can do with enemy of the state is to try to salvage or reform them through hard labor or prison or whatever. More often, you figure enemy of the state, we can't tolerate them in our midst. That's worse than excommunication. That's eradication. And therefore, Christians really under the gun. Christian leaders, of course, were the main target. If you can get rid of them, then the flock will disperse. And to some extent, that happened. A lot of the leaders were executed. A lot of the leaders were subjected to struggle, which is a technical word, accusation gatherings, which just completely abused the sensibilities, the integrity of the person. Brought friends, brought relatives, brought colleagues against a person in a take them down to Bush Stadium. A whole, you know, filled with all of those people and shouting and physical abuse. And it goes on like for 6, 7, 8 hours, just concentrated like that until a guy just kind of implodes. Horrid. And not all of them survived that, whether they died from it or weakened condition, and some of them suicide as well, just couldn't handle it. Some of the others sent out to prisons or hard labor. Christians, the church itself, driven completely out of sight, was allowed no presence whatsoever above ground. The only thing there were relics of the Christian church, like churches, sanctuaries, which had been, as had been mentioned earlier, repossessed and reassigned to other uses in society. The thing about being sent underground, however, is that from the government's point of view, it was gone. What it did, however, was kind of relegate the church to a place where the government couldn't see it, and relegated the church to those places in society where there were a lot of enemies of the state who were being re-educated. That's the polite word. And out in incredible barren boonies out there, or prisons. And in that kind of a situation, hopeless, joyless, and no sense of any future, in that kind of a situation, the Christians turned out to hang on to their faith. One thing that could not be stripped from them was the faith. That was the reason they were there. And they were in a situation where everyone else was open. They were the only people out there who had any sense of joy or hope or faith or even love for the country, in spite of the party. And in that kind of a context, they ministered incredibly meaningful ways with incredible responsiveness on the part of people who had nothing else. They had nothing. And the church began to grow in places and in ways that nobody saw. Nobody. It was underground. Government didn't see it. Who's going to tell what's going on in the prisons there, right? Besides that, it was so localized, no communication, that people in different parts of the country had no idea what was going on anywhere else. Kind of like Elijah, kind of wondering if he's the only one left. And at the same time, this was going on in places where there had never been a denomination. There had never been a mission. There had never been a missionary. There had never been any presence of the Christian church. Kind of like in the book of Acts, where it says the disciples were scattered. all through Samaria. And they went on their way preaching. Ha ha. Right, the one thing they took with them, right? Under persecution was what caused the persecution in the first place. And so when the wraps were taken off, here was a church that was vibrant. And it was a church that had felt that it had a foretaste of the resurrection. The immediate direct presence of the Lord, the suffering crucified Lord in the middle of their suffering. And as he rose, so also he brought resurrection or victory or life to the church in the middle of things, and especially when the wraps were taken off. Incredible. Now, the dynamic, however, is all of those other enemies of the state to whom the church ministered in those days, non-Christians, therefore coming to faith in a distinctly non, or if you want to use the word, post-denominational context. So the church that went into the Cultural Revolution was one that the government tried hard to strip of its denominational heritage with some antecedent bodies that had a similar agenda for different reasons, right? But the church that emerged from it is a church that didn't necessarily feel that post-denominational was a death threat anymore. It's just the way it is. You know, just in the prison, what else you got there? There are no denominations there. There are no international center there at all. And as the wraps came off, that's moving to the next section. As the wraps came off, the church just exploded in not only numbers, but in places where it had never been before. And the 50, 60 million, it's an estimate, Christians in China, great bulk of them are brought to the church in the last 10, 15 years. Well past the denominational or the mission era. To them, denominations may be something they might read about somewhere, but it certainly is not part of their experience. It's not part of their identity. And therefore, denominations are not something they particularly desire. At one point in Chinese history, the put down was one more Christian, one less Chinese. That's horrid. That'd be like saying one more Christian, one less American, right? Well, give me a break. In fact, we set ourselves up in such a way to be the best Americans that America has, right? One more Christian, one less Chinese. That's because Christians were seen as somehow subservient to, dependent on, loyal to foreign non-Chinese entities out there. Now, the church that came out of the Cultural Revolution paid some significant dues. And they lived and survived without any of that foreign help. And they survived a joyous, growing, vibrant body. You can't say one more Christian, one less Chinese. In fact, to go way down the line, a word that is heard out there now and again is anymore is one more Christian, one less criminal. Said by policemen, and not the Christians themselves. That's not a bad thing. To say. All right, your hand was coming up, and I kind of rode right by you.
China, I think that's still a problem. You know, they come out of that great, terrible before, I think they're still loyal to communist doctrine. They believe in communist regime or government. But after that, right now, I would say in China, they don't have any belief at all. That also, you know, one part is, you know, their heart is really open, their heart is empty. So they're receptive to the gospel. The other way is, right now, the economics is developing. People, you can say people really worship materialism. Most people really try to make as much money as they can in China. So I think that's important that children make some kind of impact.
Okay. From that perspective, one could say, by hindsight and by through our Christian filter, cultural revolution stripped China of the folk religions that grabbed the heart of every person at every level of society, stripped the people of the faith in communism, and left the people open. Now, just having stripped them, as the Bible says, you remove one demon, and if you don't replace that, somehow things can really be bad. And that's where even the government recognizes it's got a problem. Because that this these days also stripped the people, as Pastor Chun said, of its morality, of its etiquette, of the graciousness of life, of a lot of things. And at the same time, that's one of the reasons the Christian church is growing as fast as it is. Because it proved itself. And it has that to give, which is not to be found anywhere else out there. Easily more than a million. It's almost beyond statistics, though, because you're talking about executions, you're talking about suicides, you're talking about death by starvation or illness, you're talking about non-crops, you're talking about all kinds of dynamics. How do you even count that? You mentioned a book, and I, in spite of the fact we're almost there, there's another book about Mao that's really fascinating, The Secret Life of Chairman Mao. It sounds like a National Enquirer or something, and it's not that. By his physician, Dr. Li, who came to the States. He got the heck out of there when Chairman died, because if you're the last guy to touch him, you just may be held responsible, kind of. And there are other factors there. Came to the States, was met in at the Chinese consulate in Chicago, which is in the same building that housed the Wheat Ridge Foundation. Met by the director of the Wheat Ridge Foundation, which had been a missionary, who had been a missionary in Taiwan, spoke Chinese. Things clicked. And bring it to a quick bottom line, Dr. Li died a member of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. Who would have thunk? Who would have thought? I had one evening with him in the presence of some of those folks up in Chicago. What a almost surreal experience, talking about Zhou Enlai and about Chairman Mao and these other, like they were just household friends, you know, just ordinary people that he kind of mingled with, which he did every day. Whereas the peons like us, these are monumental, gigantic figures of history. If anyone's interested, I have a personal copy of the book. I don't know if the library does. It really ought to. Given that background, I should mention it to Prof. Berger. All right, post-denominational. We got to move on. Post-denominational became then the self-acknowledged identity with conviction of the Christian church that emerged after all of this suffering. It's true of both the registered and the unregistered church. That's the next point there. One of the dynamics that kind of helps perpetuate the post-denominational identity is the fact that, like the population of China, the Christian church is about 70% rural. There you're talking about localized forms of the Christian church. You're talking about places where largely denominations had not necessarily ever been or gone or whatever. And therefore, as those new churches continue to grow, they continue to grow in a context that just never was there. Registered church carries still a little bit of that sense of post-denominational as imposed, although they clearly have bought into it. And they're proud of it. The unregistered church, house church, or underground church, and I sort of distinguish those, underground in the sense of secretive or anti, and house church in the sense of un, just not interested in registering, and maybe some problems with that. And maybe post-denominational is not the right word to use for them. They're kind of non-denominational. They're led by strong charismatic leaders. Some of them more well-known, some of them not so well-known. Very diverse in the nature of things. They cannot call much attention to themselves. Registered church can sort of apply for foreign visitors and, you know, helpers. And I've gone there in those contexts myself. Unregistered church can't do that. It can't snuggle up to any of that denominational heritage or that denominational presence from the outside. Yeah. Now, there are those who also go under the aegis, and we have some folks in China as well, and under the aegis of more neutral bodies. We have, for instance, Concordia International School. Well, we had Christian teachers there. We have, and a lot of people have some kind of relief or social ministry agencies in different parts of China, and they're there with Christian identity, and it's not hidden. It's just that when it comes to applying for the visa, you're not going to get it as a missionary. That's an M word. An M word is a bad word. It's not four-letter, but it's still a bad word. And so that does happen, but it happens more easily and more openly in terms of the registered church. You got people snuggling up to the unregistered. That calls them into question, and it calls the person going into question. So it gets to be a little dicier, kind of a dynamic there. Yeah. Yep. 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 Okay? Yes.
You know, in my church, we have many people coming from China. So they really, they don't know why there should be so many denominations. So I told them that actually, she self patriot of the church. Actually, I see that as a denomination. It's a national church. Yeah, I see that as a denomination. And I think that I really think even the underground church, there are strong leaders
yep.
Follows. So you may say that once not local, then you say that's more or less denominational. So they do have that kind of denominational things going on there.
All right, and that leads to one of the other points I want to be sure to make, and that is that folks in China, from Bishop Ding, who is kind of the acknowledged leader, although his era is kind of going by, all the way down, acknowledge that post-denominational is also pre-denominational. For one thing, there have never been those bodies, including particularly the ones that we mentioned way back when, pre-liberation already, indigenous. Bodies never really fit easily into the Three Self Church. And they have been trying for some time to get their own seminaries or training places and their own hymnals and their own church order. And it's going to come. And the movement in the unregistered church, one significant form of movement, is a gathering of some of those major leaders. That was back in the late 90s. To draft sort of a confession of common faith and a formal statement to the government, really a kind of a request, an application for recognition without needing to be part of the Three Self Church. Well, then you got denomination, right? Different forms of well-organized Christianity operating alongside of each other. It's going to happen. And at the same time, as Bishop Ding mentioned, this was back in 89 when Dr. Karl Barth went on a junket to China. And we sat down with him in a coffee shop one time, Bishop Ding. And he kind of said at the end with a little smile on his face, he said, well, if we're going to have denominations, at least they're going to be Chinese ones. And we're not going to be, to use someone else's terms, we're not going to be making Northern Chinese into Southern Baptists. And Southern Chinese into Scandinavian Lutherans. Okay, the thing they're really concerned about, though, is that as China opens up, more and more of these freelance mission groups are coming in and trying to set up shops. Sort of like what happened in Eastern Europe and or in Russia. And boy, it hit the fan in Russia. But there you had the Orthodox Church. That made it things even dicier. Here you don't have that counterpart. But that just muddies the whole scene there. Because some of those groups are not necessarily all Western. They come from Taiwan, and they come from Hong Kong, and they come from Korea, and Singapore, and you know other areas down there. There's not a precious little networking among them. You add Western groups or Japan or whatever. That's tough. I just don't know where that's all going to go.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. It doesn't fit into this at all. Catholic Church is a monolithic body. You don't have the bringing together of different constituent bodies, and you don't have the concern is going to explode. The tension is between it is centered in the difficulty of the Vatican, of the Pope. Because Vatican claims to be the head of the Catholic Church around the world, and Chinese are not interested in just giving that authority over. And it comes to regular friction when a new bishop is appointed or consecrated, and the Pope tried to say, okay, I'll agree with that, and that's not what the Church in China wanted to hear. They don't care if you are the government, they don't care if the Pope does. And that's kind of a tough one. And therefore, you have a big split in the Catholic Church between the open Catholic Church and the underground Catholic Church, a church loyal to the Bishop of Rome, and the church that lives with the strictures of the government. Hopefully, like with the Protestant Church, hopefully those tensions will ease somewhat. You sure hope that the Vatican can work things out with China. One of the sticking points is that the Vatican as a political body recognizes Taiwan as the official, regular, normal government of all of China. Well, that's not going to fly. And the thing is, the Vatican is this big. You know, it's not a world power, but it's a matter of face. And it's just not going to go. On the other hand, from the Pope's point of view, I don't want to offend the Catholics in Taiwan. Why do I want to do that? Why do I want to make it look like the government in China is backing me into a corner and turning me against Chinese outside of China? One last thing, and we can continue privately if you would like to. We mentioned big movement. With very different dynamics from the American post-denominational scene. It was imposed. It was something accepted very reluctantly and with a lot of fear. Turned into something, however, which enlivened the church And it's seen now as something not from the government, but from God. This is a gift from God. This is a new and exciting vision of how the Church of God really ought to work. And they see this as their gift to the wider body of Christ, to you poor folks in the West who think that denominational Christianity is the divine norm. Give me a break. Why should you drive down Skinker Road here and drive past how many different Christian churches, sanctuaries, one bigger than the next? Right? That's normal. That was what God had in mind? I don't think so. Now, we can't just, you know, pretend it doesn't exist. We can't just write it off at the same time. There is, I think, a challenge that we need to take seriously out of respect to the folks in China. And at the same time, terms of constant desire to renew our own body, let's every once in a while just do a reality check. How are we doing as a denomination? Does some of the judgment of the post-denominational leaders in the States, does some of that ring true with us? Can you see some of that negative stuff at work? Are there ways we can be a little less competitive and a little less duplicative? Don't know. But I do think that we need to pray for those poor folks in China.